From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If there's one thing people across this country, conservative or liberal, can agree on, it's that we feel the earth moving under our feet on some big cultural issues that have dogged us for decades. Marijuana is one. Yesterday, it was same-sex marriage before the Supreme Court. Justices and lawyers jostling hard over gay marriage and our laws. It's going to take this country's nine top judges two months to wrestle with a Rubik's Cube of arguments here over discrimination, tradition, culture, history, equal rights, states' rights, and the role of the court itself. And then a big ruling either way. This hour on Point, gay marriage before the Supreme Court. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How do you hear the arguments? What sways you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first from Washington, Mike Sachs, reporter for the National Law Journal and Legal Times. He was there at the Supreme Court yesterday listening to the oral arguments. Mike, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
How does it appear to lean, or what's your bottom line assessment coming out of this 2.5 hours of argument?
Bottom line is that we're very likely to see a 50-state solution, same-sex marriage, as part of the 14th Amendment of the Constitution when the opinion comes down at the end of June.
That because you believe Justice Kennedy, the swing vote, is essentially leaning that way from the get-go, or because he appeared to lean that way yesterday?
Well, I would say from the get-go, given his 20 years of writing landmark gay rights opinions for the Supreme Court. But early on in the argument yesterday, he gave some case for trepidation, because there are several ways to get to yes on the question of whether states must issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. And he appeared skeptical of one argument in the beginning, which was the fundamental right to marry under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. He seemed to think that right does not extend to same-sex couples envisioned that way. He saw millennia of tradition towards opposite-sex marriage, with only recently this definition of same-sex marriage coming to the fore. And he just did not seem to buy a broader definition under that rubric. But later on in the opinion, in the argument, he seemed to believe, and quite strongly, that denying same-sex couples marriage licenses does impugn their dignity as citizens and people. And that's more of an equal protection violation. And that was his rationale under the last big gay rights case that came 2 years ago in the Windsor case that struck down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act.
Mike, let's hear those back to back. This was early on, questioning Mary Bonuato, the lawyer for the same-sex couples. Justice Kennedy, likely the swing vote here, asked whether the traditional definition of marriage should be changed, whether the court is in a place to do that.
This definition has been with us for millennia, and it's very difficult for the court to say, oh, well, we know better.
Well, I don't think this is a question of the court knowing better. When we think about the debate, the place of gay people in our civic society is something that has been contested for more than a century.
But the justice, the swing vote, looking at millennia of tradition there. Later, here's Michigan lawyer John Bursch representing states with same-sex marriage bans that are on the line here. He asserted, John Bursch, attorney, that marriage is not an institution intended to be dignity-bestowing. Swing vote, Justice Kennedy pushed back on that one.
I thought that was the whole purpose of marriage. It bestows dignity on both man and woman in a traditional marriage. And these parties say they want to have that same ennoblement.
Mike Sachs, remind us here of the court's options for decisions and their potential implications. You say that if you had to call it today, you see, a 50-state green light for green marriage coming out of this. But what are the different ways they could decide, and what would be the implications?
Wow, there are many ways they can decide and many different implications. So the easiest, most simple, is what we've already described. The court, probably 5-4, maybe 6-3, we can get to that in a moment, will say that states must, under the 14th Amendment, probably the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, must issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. Now, the court had two questions presented yesterday. There was that question, and then there was also, if that is a no, then must states under the 14th Amendment recognize the same-sex marriage licenses that were bestowed in other states that did recognize same-sex marriage. So, say, Michigan prevails in this case in the first question. They don't have to mandate same-sex marriage. Then, someone coming from New York, moving to Michigan, who is married in New York, Michigan would have to recognize their marriage if it's yes in the second question. It seemed, by the end of the argument, again looking at Justice Kennedy, that they won't even have to get to that question. Kennedy asked one pretty milquetoast question in the very beginning of that second argument, and then he just checked out. Other observers in the courtroom said that after that question, he really just leaned back and seemed disinterested in what was going on, which implicates, if you're doing the usual Kennedy Kremlinology, which all of us court watchers love to do, it implies that he knew where he was going and that answer was very likely yes to same-sex marriage in all 50 states because John Birch, the lawyer from Michigan, insisted on telling Justice Kennedy what dignity meant. And no one tells Justice Kennedy what dignity means in the individual rights in the individual rights arena. That has been his lodestar, his constitutional lodestar, in determining whether equal protection or due process guarantees apply to individuals asserting that they have those rights under those guarantees. Now, if there's no to no, if there is no same-sex right to marriage under the Constitution and states neither have to issue it nor recognize other states that issue it, then that throws into question what's happening in states that have started recognizing same-sex marriage in the months since the Supreme Court let several other appeals court decisions just go into effect. There was that moment earlier, I guess towards the end of 2014, where the court was presented with appeals from the Ninth Circuit, from the Fourth Circuit, from the Seventh Circuit, all of which said same-sex marriage, yes. And the court denied those petitions, and that pretty much doubled the amount of states nationwide that permitted same-sex marriage.
36 now.
Right. Now it's 36, right. If the court says no, there's no constitutional guarantee, I really don't know, and I have to defer perhaps to your guests later on in the hour. I really don't know what's going to happen to those opinions they let stand several months ago. That's going to be kind of crazy. But at the same time, you have to look at the reality of what happened yesterday at the oral argument, and although oral arguments are not dispositive of how things will come out, it looked very clear, almost certain, that this will be a 5-4, if not a 6-3 decision. Now, the 6-3 issue comes from Chief Justice Roberts, and Chief Justice Roberts is not likely to sign on to any opinion by Justice Kennedy or the liberals that talk about dignity, that talk about equal protection. He's already been on the record in Windsor saying he just doesn't see that sexual orientation is a suspect classification that requires same-sex marriage to be issued by the states. But he did show some interest in the question of whether denials of same-sex marriage licenses amounts to sex discrimination rather than sexual orientation discrimination. And that's been embraced by several judges, a district judge. There was a circuit judge, Judge Berzin, on the Ninth Circuit last year. And, you know, he said something very, you know, just one question, then he let it go. And some observers said, you know, that might not be an issue then. He probably just was airing it out. But he has now, it seems to be, a habit, a tradition, a custom of just bringing up these little things in big cases, throwing a hint of where he's going. In the Prop 8 case a couple years ago, that might have seemed like it was going to do what is being asked of the court this year. He said, well, what about standing? You know, did the defendants in this case even have standing? And boom, 5-4 decision at the end of June. No standing for the defendants in the case. Case got kicked back to the Ninth Circuit, and same-sex marriage fell on a technicality in California. And then in the big Obamacare case 2 years ago, in the NFIB case, he said, well, could this count as a tax? And then boom, at the end of June, his opinion, 5-4 with the liberals, although he split with them on the Commerce Clause, he said, this is a tax. And therefore, the individual mandate penalty, rather, is a tax. And therefore, the Obamacare lives to see another day. So that quick question he asked about sex discrimination as opposed to sexual orientation discrimination could prove dispositive for his vote to make sure that he is not on the other side of history in what he wants to see as his legacy as the institutional conservator of the Supreme Court that bears his name.
Mike Sachs, reporter with National Law Journal and Legal Times. Thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Mike was in the court yesterday. So was Camilla Taylor, Marriage Project Director for Lambda Legal, a national organization, works for civil rights of lesbians, gay men, bisexuals, transgender people. She was in the courtroom as part of the legal team arguing for gay marriage. Joins us from Washington, Camilla Taylor. What do you think? Mike Sachs thinks maybe you've got it in the bag. Does it look that way to you?
Well, I share Mike's optimism. Thanks for having me on, Tom. I think there was a lot from which we can draw a lot of encouragement that the court is going to do the right thing and is going to require all of the states in the country to permit same-sex couples the freedom to marry.
And that encouragement, from your perspective, comes from what in particular yesterday?
Well, as Mike mentioned, all of us were listening very closely to the questions asked by Justice Kennedy, who's often viewed as a swing vote on the court, and also the Chief, Justice Roberts. And while I have some, I guess, small differences with Mike with respect to how Mike anticipates that the court will rule, I think that Justice Kennedy's questions showed a very great discomfort with some of the arguments that were made, particularly by the state of Michigan, in suggesting that same-sex couples should be fenced out of marriage. The state of Michigan was trying to claim that the purpose of marriage is to link biological parents to their biological children. And Justice Kennedy pushed back on that, saying that the state of Michigan was relying on a faulty premise that only different-sex couples can bond with their children. And as Justice Kennedy put it, that's just a wrong premise. In Windsor, Justice Kennedy showed a great deal of concern for the impact of discrimination on the children of same-sex couples. And specifically, he pointed out that when government discriminates against same-sex couples by denying them recognition for their marriages, that that communicates to the children that there's something wrong with their families.
And what about his question in which he said, you know, the definition traditional has been with us for millennia, difficult for the court to say we know better. What about that?
Well, I think the justice was wrestling with when is the right time for the court to step in. But as he pointed out in that same question, this case has come up within the same time frame as the court used in Loving versus Virginia in 1967 when the court struck down bans on interracial marriage, which was about the same distance away from Brown versus Board of Education.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about gay marriage, same-sex marriage before the U.S. Supreme Court and the ultimate arguments on a big social change underway in this country. Pro-gay marriage supporters outside the Supreme Court yesterday, anti as well. Here was pro. Susan Kent had traveled up from Key West, Florida.
I'm excited. It's time. Love must win. It's time for marriage equality. It's time for equality for everyone.
Inside the courtroom, inside the Supreme Court, anti-same-sex marriage protesters began to yell in the middle of arguments, was removed from the courtroom, yelling abomination.
The Bible teaches us that if you support gay marriage, then you can march in hell for eternity!
Camilla Taylor is with us. She's with Lambda Legal. She was in the courtroom yesterday, part of the legal team arguing for gay marriage. We'll hear the arguments for and against in a moment. Camilla, this last question for you. If it should go the other way, if somehow Justice Kennedy doesn't stay on the track that he appears to have been on, if it's not the law of the land, if states are upheld in their rights to consider it themselves, what would that mean for a group like yours and the pro-same-sex marriage camp? What would the legal strategy be then?
Well, we'll continue fighting for the freedom to marry nationwide. I don't think a loss is likely, as I mentioned earlier. Many of the victories that we've won in states have been either through legislation or referenda or through state court victories based on state constitutions. So, of course, they will stand. In addition, many of the federal victories we've won are cases that are now fully concluded. And so I think they will stand as well, or at least it will be quite difficult for our opponents to reopen them. And then there are many people who have married in reliance on those victories, and even our opponents agree that those marriages remain valid regardless. So I think we have a lot of reason to be very hopeful that we will get a victory in just a very few weeks from the Supreme Court that will require all states to permit same-sex couples to marry. But regardless of what the court does, this is a struggle that will continue.
Camilla Taylor with Lambda Legal, Marriage Project Director there in the courtroom yesterday with the Supreme Court. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
In just a moment, we'll hear from Lynn Wardell at Brigham Young University against Kenji Yoshino at New York University for. There's a lot of history here. Back in 2003, Justice Kennedy wrote a majority opinion saying that even if the framers of the Constitution could not have predicted the future, they understood that ideas of personal liberty would change with the times.
It is the promise of the Constitution that there is a realm of personal liberty which the government may not enter. They knew times can blind us to certain truths, and later generations can see that laws once thought necessary and proper, in fact, serve only to oppress.
Only to oppress in time. But Justice Scalia, also in 2003, same case, said this, no, this is about taking sides, the High Court taking sides in culture war.
It is clear from this that the court has taken sides in the culture war, and in particular in that battle of the culture war that concerns whether there should be any moral opprobrium attached to homosexual conduct.
And this year, just in February, Justice Antonin Scalia saying that he wasn't arguing the morality of gay marriage, but whether it's the job of the court to decide whether society should accept it.
Don't, you know, paint me as anti-gay or anything else. The point is, who decides? Should these decisions be made by the Supreme Court without any text in the Constitution or any history in the Constitution to support imposing that on the whole country? Or is it a matter left to the people?
And here, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg responding to Justice Scalia's question about whether the people of the courts should decide such sensitive issues as same-sex marriage.
As I see it, it isn't the Supreme Court that is deciding for the whole society like an imperial ruler. There hasn't been any major change in which there wasn't a groundswell among the people before the Supreme Court put its stamp of approval.
Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, just in February, background to what we heard in the Supreme Court yesterday. Let's dig on into the arguments there. Kenji Yoshino joins us now, professor of constitutional law at New York University, was in the gallery during yesterday's oral arguments. He's author of Speak Now, Marriage Equality on Trial, Hollingsworth versus Perry. You can link to some of that at our website, onpointradio.org. Is a married gay man with two children. Kenji Yoshino, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
And from Provo, Utah, Lynn Wardell joins us, professor of law at Brigham Young University, focuses on family law. He filed an amicus brief on behalf of opponents of gay marriage. Author was with Lawrence Noland of Fundamental Principles of Family Law. Lynn Wardell in Provo, Utah, thank you for being here.
Hi, Tom and Kenji. Thanks for having me.
Lynn, first to you. Our reporter, Mike Sack, says it looks to him like it's going to go to a 50-state solution here. Pro-same-sex marriage. Camilla Taylor, she's with Lambda Legal. She's got an interest in this, but her sense conveyed here anyway today, the same. What about you listening yesterday? Do you see the court signing off green-lighting same-sex marriage for the entire nation?
Well, those kinds of predictions are always difficult. Reading judges is as difficult as reading tea leaves. But if I had to make a prediction, I think that I would agree that Justice Kennedy seems inclined to interpret the Constitution as requiring all states to legalize same-sex marriage. The trajectory, direction of his past opinions certainly would lead to that conclusion. And I heard nothing in the questioning yesterday that would that would lead me to conclude otherwise. So I'm, from my point of view, I think that's a very disappointing and troubling decision. It ought to be of grave concern, not just for the substance of marriage and the issue of what that means in our culture, but the way that we decide important questions like this and the way that we use the Constitution. I think that it's a distortion of the system of government and the process of government that the founders established to turn this over to the decision of nine Platonic guardians and have them decide for the whole country issues concerning family law, and marriage is the core of family law, which constitutionally were issues that were left by the founders to the states to regulate, not certainly for the federal government to regulate, and certainly not for the unelected federal judiciary to decide and impose upon the states.
Lynn Wardell, you don't favor same-sex marriage. Reading the tea leaves is difficult, no doubt. You've been following this for a long time. Given the history here, Justice Kennedy and beyond, what was there something you anticipated you might hear yesterday that you didn't, but that you might have from Justice Kennedy or otherwise that might have left you feeling that it might actually go against same-sex marriage?
Justice Kennedy is somewhat cautious, that is, he's got a clear agenda, but he seeks to not impose it blatantly, but more deftly. And I think that the oral argument yesterday really didn't shed a whole lot of light on what approach they're going to take. But I think that nothing that he said would suggest that he's anticipating changing the direction of his thinking, which has been laid out in a number of cases for the last 20 years.
Kenji Yoshino, you've followed this very closely for a long time as well. Here it is for the biggest decision yet in the courts on same-sex marriage. What was most striking to you about the oral argument yesterday, and where do you see this headed?
Well, I agree that the Supreme Court is going to strike down these bans on same-sex marriage. I think one of the more striking things in yesterday's decision goes directly to Lynn's point. So Lynn was saying we shouldn't take this away from the people. Justice Kagan, in an exchange with one of the attorneys for the defenders of these bans, really engaged with that issue, saying we don't live in a simple democracy. We live in a constitutional democracy, so the Constitution places limits on what we can do. And to the point that family law has traditionally been state law, you know, the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution says no state shall deny with any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Mm-hmm. Now, they didn't say equal protection on the basis of race. You know, race is obviously topmost in their minds. They didn't, but they didn't say that. They said equal protection for everybody. And so that equal protection principle is something that can extend across time to protect new groups that have been discriminated against. And so there are constitutional limits even on the decision-making powers of states, even with regard to issues that are traditional state domains, as family law certainly is.
So you see it most likely going that way. What about Justice Roberts and his interesting interventions yesterday, Kenji?
Yeah, I thought that was a brilliant question, and it was really mind-boggling to me because Justice Kennedy had asked exactly that question in 2013.
Remind us of the question once more, if you would.
Oh, I'm sorry. The question was whether or not these bans on same-sex marriage constitute sex discrimination or not. And the reason that this is relevant is, first of all, if the question is skipping from Justice Kennedy, who everyone thinks is going to be the fifth vote, to Chief Justice Roberts, who people thought was much less sympathetic to on this issue, then it may be that Chief Justice Roberts sees the way the tide is turning and doesn't want to be on the wrong side of history as someone who cares deeply about the legitimacy of the Supreme Court. I entirely also agree with Mike earlier in the program when he said that Chief Justice Roberts often does, you know, tip his hand during oral arguments towards the things that are going to ground his decision. The reason that it's important, Tom, mm-hmm. is that sex discrimination already has heightened scrutiny or heightened protection under the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. Sexual orientation does not. And so if this is a sex discrimination opinion, then we move into a world where the laws defining marriage as between one man and one woman move from being presumptively constitutional to being presumptively unconstitutional. And it's actually a very forceful argument insofar as what Robert said was, if a man can marry a woman, but a man cannot marry a man, then the only thing that stands as a barrier here is sex discrimination, not sexual orientation discrimination. And the reason that this has been experienced as a gay rights case, of course, is that, you know, it's only gay individuals who want to enter into such marriages. But on its face, these laws discriminate much more on the basis of sex than on sexual orientation. A gay man could marry a lesbian under these laws.
Let's go to that question from the Chief Justice, Michigan's Attorney John Bursch, representing the states with same-sex marriage bans, was arguing that allowing gay marriages would negatively impact heterosexual marriages, causing a decline in the number of straight marriages. Chief Justice John Roberts went back to a more basic idea of gender fairness. Here he is.
I'm not sure it's necessary to get into sexual orientation to resolve the case. I mean, if Sue loves Joe and Tom loves Joe, Sue can marry him and Tom can't. And the difference is based upon their different sex. Why isn't that a straightforward question of sexual discrimination?
Lynn Wardell in Provo, Utah, what about the Chief Justice's line of thinking there? This isn't about sexuality or sexual identity. It's about gender and sex discrimination.
Well, certainly it's an obvious point. Marriage has always historically, not just in this country, but in every country, in every society, throughout history, has always been the union of a man and a woman. And that's because of the importance of the family for procreation, child rearing, for future generations, for the future of society. So that integration of male and female has been critical to the understanding of marriage across cultures, across time. I don't see any indication that the court wants to assume the responsibility to change that. I think, however, they may. I think that my concern is that, well, today of the 193 sovereign nations in the world, only 17 have legalized same-sex marriage. And of those 17, only one has done so by a judicial order rather than through a democratic legislative process. 16 of the 17 nations have adopted same-sex marriage have done so through debate, discussion of the legislature, and finally a legislative resolution. Only one nation, Brazil, has decided it as a matter of judicial decree. And I think we are teetering on the edge of following Brazil in ways more than just in this decision, in ways that would be inconsistent with the vision of constitutional democracy that the founders had when they wrote the Constitution and established this nation.
A little tape here going in that direction. Here was Justice Samuel Alito referring to the long tradition of marriage.
How do you account for the fact that, as far as I'm aware, until the end of the 20th century, there never was a nation or a culture that recognized marriage between two people of the same sex? Or is it your argument that they were all operating independently based solely on irrational stereotypes and prejudice?
Kenji Yoshino, what about that? The question, you know, were all these millennia, as Justice Kennedy had it, of tradition here, of convention, based on prejudice and irrational stereotypes?
Yeah, not necessarily. I'm perfectly willing to say that, you know, at its founding, when marriage was established, you know, it wasn't done with the intent to box out gay people. This is something that Chief Justice Roberts has asked in earlier arguments, say in the Windsor case. So I'm perfectly willing to concede that. The question is not really that question. The question is rather whether or not things that begin innocently can be maintained for invidious purposes. So there's a 1982 case from the Supreme Court that says that in its origins, this particular electoral system, which was an at-large electoral system, may have been innocent, but it has been maintained for invidious, racially discriminatory purposes. I would make the analogous argument here. We don't need to argue anything about what marriage was in its origins. All we need to do is to say that when we look at these current state bans that, for example, in the Prop 8 case were enacted to supersede judicial opinions that had granted same-sex marriage, if we look at the campaigns surrounding those initiatives, we see a lot of anti-gay sentiment, or at least misunderstanding of gay individuals.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about same-sex marriage. Before the U.S. Supreme Court, the ultimate arguments on a big, big social change that's been rolling across this country. Lynn Wardle is with us from Provo, Utah, professor of law at Brigham Young University, focuses on family law. Kenji Yoshino is with us, professor of constitutional law at New York University, author of Speak Now, Marriage Equality on Trial, Hollingsworth versus Perry, just out this month. John Birch, who was representing opposition to same-sex marriage, said the debate is not about how to define marriage, he told the court, but about who rules the country, the courts, or the people. He said, we're asking you to affirm every individual's fundamental liberty interest in deciding the meaning of marriage. But Justice Sotomayor cut him off sharply right there, said nobody's taking away rights from anybody, but that everybody has a right to decide what marriage means and to act on it. Here's Justice Sotomayor.
Every single individual in this society chooses, if they can, their sexual orientation or who to marry or not marry. I suspect even with us giving gays rights to marry that there are some gay people who will choose not to, just as there are some heterosexual couples who choose not to marry. So we're not taking anybody's liberty away.
The liberty point from Justice Sotomayor. Sue in Georgetown, Texas. Sue, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes. The issue for me is government intervention in something that should be between two people. I have personal experience. My grandmother, who was born in Maryland in 1914, mm-hmm. married a Japanese man. Mm-hmm. Because of the Act of 1907, she lost her citizenship, and she was not to regain it until 1922, when a senator, oddly, spoke up and said, wait, this is all wrong, to be discriminatory. And I can tell you that...
In marriage, that, yeah.
Yes. A Caucasian person marrying an, in quotes, alien, was lost their citizenship. But the issue is discrimination in general, and with our governments feeling they have a right to determine who marries whom. It shouldn't be an issue. It's none of their business. It's between the two people involved.
Sue, I appreciate your call. Lynn Wardle, a parallel there. I mean, today, Sue's story hits us in all the wrong ways. Denied marriage on the basis of nationality and maybe race. Do the same fundamental issues come into play here? She's saying, let people be free on this front. Give them maybe the liberty, Justice Sotomayor was talking about.
Well, I agree with her case as an egregious example of racism and the intertwining of marriage restrictions with racial restrictions that is certainly a black eye, a blot on the integrity of our country. Loving versus Virginia began to remedy that back in 1967. It was interpreting a 14th Amendment, which had been enacted a century earlier and yet had laid dormant, the court refusing to fulfill its responsibility to enforce and the rights guaranteed by that amendment. But Loving versus Virginia is a good example of why this is different. In Loving, you had the results of racism that was led to the a Supreme Court decision regarding racism that led to a civil war that left 600,000 Americans dead on battlefields across the country and resulted in a profound consensus of society. That kind of constitutional powerful consensus with regard to same-sex marriage simply does not exist today in this country. Indeed, I'm not sure it exists in any country in the world. This is an issue that's in play. There are a lot of feelings and a lot of different values and approaches and perspectives that are implicated. I think some of the most serious implications of legalizing same-sex marriage concern religious liberty, concern the continued disintegration of the nuclear family, concern the welfare of children who flourish best when raised by a mom and a dad. And so there are serious long-term social implications of how the court decides this case. And I think that we all would be best served if the court would simply say, as is true, the Constitution simply doesn't address this issue, but it set up a system for the resolution of issues like this, namely a democratic self-government. State by state, these issues can be resolved, and they have been in the past. And what we have now is simply an effort to circumvent that constitutional process by convincing the a court to judicially impose a solution upon the entire nation.
I mean, sometimes they've been solved in that way, and sometimes they haven't. As you point out, we had a civil war.
Yeah, and it was a bloody war that was necessary to establish a principle that had been an unfulfilled promise of the founders, going back to the 1787 founders. The question is one – there are a number of questions, but one of the important questions that's alluded to earlier is who should decide this, how it should be decided, by what process should it be decided?
Kenji Yoshino, I want to bring all that to you. Let me get a call here, if I may, first. Gabe in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Gabe, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I would just like to say that this argument put out by Scalia, picked up by your guest and others, that the Supreme Court should not be involved in this decision, it frankly is total hogwash. And I know Scalia knows that. I mean, he's a very intelligent man. He's obviously a genius. But he has intervened in the culture before. I would point toward Bush v. Gore, where he was happy to make a decision there. And also at the same time, write that the decision should not be followed in the future, which is, totally selling out the Supreme Court, to satisfy his people. And here I see the same thing. I mean, of course they should be involved. It's time now. In fact, it's past time. And Scalia saying otherwise, or, Roberts looking for, sex discrimination as a way out. These guys are just looking for cover now because they know they're on the wrong side of history. And I respect that change is hard, but it's coming. It's here. It's beautiful. And, it's time to get on board.
Gabe, let us pick that up, and I appreciate your call. A couple of clips right here. One from neither of those two, but rather from typically seen as a more liberal-leaning justice, Stephen Breyer, wondering aloud yesterday whether the nine justices of the court should take it upon themselves to redefine marriage instead of letting the states or voters in each state decide. Here's Breyer.
Suddenly, you want nine people outside the ballot box to require states that don't want to do it to change what you've heard is change what marriage is to include gay people. Why cannot those states at least wait and see?
Wait and see. Why not? Saying Breyer there at that moment in the oral arguments. And Chief Justice Roberts saying we might be better off if we let this work its way through a more difficult process. Here's Roberts.
But if you prevail here, there will be no more debate. And it will have a consequence on how this new institution is accepted. People feel very differently about something if they have a chance to vote on it than if it's imposed on them by the courts.
Kenji Yoshino, there's several things I want to ask about, but what about those two comments from the two justices there yesterday?
Yeah, I think that the answers that were given by the individuals to whom the questions are posed are quite instructive here. So, one of the answers given by Mary Bonato was every time that you wait, this kind of wait-and-see attitude is not neutral. And so you have to think about the harms that you're imposing through this wait-and-see attitude. And then Don Verrilli for the United States arguing for restricting or striking down the restrictions on same-sex marriage said, if you actually validate this and let the conversation continue, that too is not a default because you're essentially saying that it is all right under the Constitution and under the Equal Protection Clause to treat gay people differently. And what he said is gay people are equal. They deserve the equal protection of the laws, and they deserve it now.
Kenji, what about the points that Lynn Wardle made earlier, asserting that we will see if this goes through law of the land problems with religious liberty issues? Destruction or erosion of the nuclear family, says Lynn. Issues with the welfare of children who he says are better off with mother and father, male and female.
Yeah, so it's interesting that we've seen Justice Breyer in the oral arguments yesterday say, you know, I've heard two arguments. One is tradition, the millennia of moral teaching. And to that, can I just say that the Supreme Court has made it really clear that tradition standing alone cannot, barricade or protect a law from being struck down. If that were the case, then the interracial marriage bans would still be potentially with us today. The second point was about religious liberty. And the litigants actually disavowed for the states, disavowed any reliance on either of those two rationales. And I think with good reason. I mean, Justice Scalia came riding in and said, you know, isn't there a religious liberties problem where ministers will be forced to marry same-sex couples in civil ceremonies and so on and so forth? And Justice Kagan said, what are you talking about? You know, there are many instances in which rabbis refuse to marry Jewish people to non-Jewish people. No one has come out against them. And, you know, everybody understands that a core principle, the free exercise clause, is that individuals for religious purposes are permitted to marry whomever they want. And so that to me seems like a non-issue. And in fact, I would say John Birch for the state of Michigan agreed that that was a non-issue because that wasn't his argument. Interestingly, Tom, to your point about optimal child rearing and
Lynn's point, really, but I'm conveying it to you.
Yes, indeed. So Professor Wardle's point about the optimal child rearing scenario being a man and a woman, this has been debunked by social science over and over again, including in the trial below. And so one of the themes of my book is how important trials are in these conversations because, you know, you and I and Professor Wardle can get on the radio and make all these points, but we can't really dig into them. And it's through no fault of ours. It's just the medium that prevents us from going really deep. But when you're actually on the stand under cross-examination for open-ended periods of time, it's really hard to run out the clock or pivot away from the question. So I would just refer readers to listeners to the trials that were held in this case, whether the Prop 8 trial or the Michigan trial, that soundly discredited this view that the man-woman pairing gave rise to the optimal child-rearing unit. Same-sex couples are raising children all over the country. There are tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of children being raised by same-sex couples, and they're doing just as well. The only thing that they're being deprived of is the right to marry and to further strengthen their families.
So you're actually asserting there, Kenji, as you do in your book Speak Now, that the courts are the better place in some circumstances because evidence can be methodically laid out.
Yeah, I want to draw a distinction between where the best conversation is happening and where the most democratically legitimate conversation is happening. So, you know, I understand where Professor Wardle is coming from because, you know, I think that a lot of us have this discomfort with judges deciding these issues and taking them away from the people. I happen not to think that that's an issue in this case because there's a constitutional principle, namely the Equal Protection Clause, that's at stake here. And I haven't heard Professor Wardle answer the point about whether or not this is sex discrimination or whether or not he thinks sex discrimination is unconstitutional under the U.S. Constitution. But I want to separate all of that, the legitimacy question, from where is the best conversation happening. And that, to me, is a no-brainer, like compared to legislative hearings, media debates, even academic debates. And I should be embarrassed about that because I'm an academic. You know, you don't get the same level of rigor because you don't have people testifying under oath for open-ended periods of time without the ability to avoid cross-examination on their viewpoints. And so for me, the Perry trial, which is what I focus on, was a shining civil rights document that debunked every single one of the rationales against same-sex marriage, whether that be the deinstitutionalization of heterosexual marriage argument or whether that be the optimal child-rearing argument or whatever other argument that you have.
Lynn Wardle, the equal protection argument here, how do you respond on that front?
Well, it's a matter of how you evaluate or measure equality. And again, in terms of outcomes for children who are raised by a mother and a father and those who are raised in other family environments, including same-sex and as well as other ones, the outcomes are just unequivocal, just indisputable.
We've heard Kenji dispute that directly just now. And right. Here's an example of what Kenji's saying. We can't take 4 hours to nail that down. But nevertheless, doesn't the equal protection problem still stand?
I think that what we see here is the court tottering on the edge of falling into the mistake it made, 42 years ago, 1973, when it decided Roe versus Wade and said, we are the wisest and best position to decide whether abortion should be legal on demand throughout at least after the first trimester of pregnancy. And Roe versus Wade remains an illegitimate, highly criticized, highly provocative decision. People gather annually to protest, and I think we're on the verge of seeing the court decide the Roe versus Wade of same-sex marriage, which is going to complicate democratic self-government in this country.
Kenji, I won't argue the legitimacy of Roe v. Wade, but John Roberts raises the similar issue. Could we, 30, 40 years down the road, still be debating this if the court gets too far out over its skis here?
I don't think so. In Roe versus Wade, you have a secular interest on the other side. So whether you agree or disagree, you know, there is an interest on the other side, which is the potential life of the fetus, represented by the fetus. In this instance, there is no argument on the other side that is not religious in nature. And
Kenji Yoshino at New York University, author of Speak Now, Lynn Wardle at Brigham Young University, thanks for joining us. This is On Point.